Hi, everyone. I just wanted to give you a heads up that we've got a little bit of bad language in today's episode, just in case you've got some little ears that'll be tuning in and listening to the podcast. You may want to listen on your own first before sharing with them, but I hope you enjoy the commentary nonetheless. Thank you very much for listening.
Welcome to Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. This is our very special Psycho Listen Live episode. We are joined by Chris Haig, Brandon Shematala, and our special guest, our man who knows exactly enough, associate producer Pat McFadden, live from LA. And without further ado, Brandon Shea, hit play. Everybody hit play on your device. 3, 2, 1. And we are watching Psycho. This is very exciting.
So the version that I have, just to explain, I've got the Universal logo coming up right now, so the planet U just came by, just so I'm not quite sure. You might have a different version of this movie. I'll just explain kind of what we're seeing here. I won't do this for the whole thing. We see the full planet now. It's fading to black and a Paramount release.
Excellent. So how exciting is this? Ever since we launched the podcast, we've been talking about the importance of the movie Psycho, and this is a tangent. We're getting off of our chronological sequencing of the films. We're going to do a special episode every once in a while about Psycho, and so today we decided, let's do a walkthrough. Let's do a listen live of the entire movie. Thank you, everybody. Yes. Thank you, everybody, for getting in on this today. And welcome, of course, Pat, our special guest.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming to the show, Pat. So, hey, Pat, tell us a little bit about your history with Hitchcock here before we start talking about the film while the credits are rolling.
Oh, I've just been a geek most of my adult life. Actually, all of my adult life, because I was about 12 when I discovered Psycho. It all began with Psycho. I've seen every movie multiple times. I've read a lot. I've watched over and over again, you know, so that's really my only credential, is that I'm a hitchaholic.
Mm. Excellent. Would you describe yourself as Psycho?
Yeah.
Ask my mother.
So what's your favorite Hitchcock film?
It varies. I would say Psycho because that started it all. I would say Shadow of a Doubt because I think that's his best, actually. Mm-hmm. But it's just too difficult to choose between my children.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right on. Well, this is going to be interesting because this is our first live commentary for the podcast, and so it's going to be a little bit of a longer podcast, obviously. Directed by Alfred Hitchcock is on the screen right now, and it's going left and right, and we got the city, and it says, I'll read it when it comes up, the date and time. Phoenix, Arizona.
Time of day.
I know. I'm
Friday, December the 11th. There
and
we go.
Pat, you visited this location before, haven't you?
Yes, I have. That building is still there. This building we're seeing right now.
Mm-hmm. At 2:43 p.m.
Yes, and I stood underneath there on Friday, December the 11th at 2:43 p.m.
Good for you.
Well, that's cool.
Excellent. Was there an affair going on in that room?
No. Probably. It was empty, actually.
I mean, probably. It was Phoenix, right?
Like, yeah.
So this is the famous love scene in one of the interviews in the Truffaut book that Hitchcock explains that in reality, he would have had both of them topless, but she, of course, was wearing the bra just for the sake of propriety.
Because it was 1960.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And they talk about how The direction he gave the two of them here was that she was a lot more interested in the lovemaking than he was. So she had to be a bit more aggressive, and he was a bit more disinterested.
He was wooden.
Well, apparently that...
And not in the way that helped.
Well, from what I read, that that problem popped up at least once, and they had to kind of slow things down. being very, that would be so nerve-wracking as actors, though, right? Like, how do you
I know,
do that
really
in front
hard.
Of a crew, you know, a camera crew? And that would just be a very stressful assignment.
Yeah, and I've seen a lot of other things he's in, and he's not even as good as Rock Hudson, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
What, who's this guy? What's his name?
John Gavin.
Okay. What else have you seen him in?
Let's see, what else? Spartacus.
Okay, yeah.
Where he looks great, you know, in a toga. Imitation of Life, 1959. He was in a bunch of things around that time, and they were grooming him to be the successor to Rock Hudson, but ultimately it didn't really work. He later was the American ambassador to Mexico.
Oh, really?
He's actually Latino.
Okay.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, the Hitchcock wanted us to all feel as if, you know, I resent this term, a peeping Tom. We were all peeping Toms. Sneaking in the window and watching this couple have their tryst in the afternoon.
I wonder if that was a reference to the movie, then, Peeping Tom. Pat, do you know that film, Peeping Tom, by Powell?
Yes, I have seen it, and I haven't seen it often, and there is debate as to whether it was an influence in making Psycho. I think the jury is still out on that. The definite influence, though, was Lady Abelique. I'm sure you guys know about that one.
That's by, give me half a second here, the French guy that did Clouseau.
Yes.
Oh, Henri I love George. Diabolique. Diabolique is so good, man. That ending is just off-the-wall epic.
Totally. So,
I got to see, my wife and I went to France. And for our honeymoon, and like part of the things that we saw, we went to the I can't remember the name of the cemetery. I don't know why I can never remember it. But we went, and part of the trip was going to this cemetery. And I went out of my way, and I got to see the graves of Truffaut and Clouseau. And it was hard. It was at a different cemetery, but we found Jacques Tati's grave as well. And it was so sad because it was, you know, it was an above ground sarcophagus for Jacques Tati, and it had been like worn away with weather, and you could like barely read his name. And it has his full name of Jacques Tati Chef, but we're going way off on tangent. But Clouseau is amazing. If you guys haven't seen Diabolique, you got to see Diabolique. If you like Psycho, if you like Hitchcock, you will love it. If you haven't seen Peeping Tom, you'll love it because that's a very much in this kind of style of film.
Hitchcock says regarding this scene that he spelled out the time of day and told people we're in Phoenix. He wanted to lead up to the important fact that it was 2:43 in the afternoon. This is the only time this poor girl has to be in bed with her lover. And it suggests that she spent the entire lunch hour with him.
And that's a long lunch hour, though. 2:43 p.m., though? I actually never thought of that till just now.
And here's another Hitchcock.
This is his daughter.
This is Patricia. I love her role here. Now, this is the mother theme. Mother gave me a painkiller on my wedding day, and my husband was mad because she basically was sedated on her honeymoon. Like, controlling mothers everywhere. My mother called to see if Teddy called. Like, cut the apron string, people.
Now, this isn't the first film that Patricia Hitchcock's been in. She was also in Stage Fright. I don't know if she was in any others. Do you know off the top of your head?
Oh, Strangers on a Train.
Strangers on a Train as well, yep.
Yeah, so. She had her biggest role in that. And it was partly because she resembled... who was the lead in that? Ruth Roman.
Okay.
And now, when you get up to that film, you'll, of course, see why. So that's Frank Albertson. And... he was very active in the 30s, but aside from this, people know him best from It's a Wonderful Life, where he was the hee-haw George guy who was trying to get George Bailey to go in on plastics.
Hmm.
Oh my god!
So yeah. this guy is rich. He's about to drop $40,000 cash on the table to buy his daughter a wedding gift of a house. And he's a.
And you all heard that $40,000 was Tony Perkins' fee for the movie.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Did they pay him cash?
No.
So, this guy's a drinker. He's a bit of a chauvinist. He's a bit rude with the women in the office, but he's an important client. So the manager here is doing everything he can to make this rich dude Tom happy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're nervous about what to do with all this money. How could it go wrong to give someone in the office the money and send her to the bank with it?
That's my favorite line where he's talking about the bottle in the desk.
It's like, oh. It's just,
and the boss has air conditioning. The boss's office has air conditioning, but the women don't in the front office.
They don't, yeah. Like, oh, the good old days we could drink at work.
Yeah.
In Arizona, yeah.
It'd be hot down there, right?
Yeah.
We're trusting you with the money.
Mm-hmm.
I love the line about the wedding ring.
He was flirting with you because he must have seen the wedding ring.
Yeah, that's what he noticed. Yeah. Yeah.
Not because she's a lot prettier than you, just, yeah. You know, anyway.
It's like, no, he knew I was married, not the fact that this is, you know, Janet Leigh.
I'm surprised they didn't go, air conditioning, shut the door! You're letting the air conditioning out.
My new boss, I gotta say, I love my new boss because he's kind of like this guy here, where it's like pretty relaxed and he lets you work and have a family. He's like, look, I got a headache, I'm gonna go home. So,
after what you need is a weekend in Las Vegas, and she says, I'm going to spend the weekend in bed, a line was cut where he says, the only playground that beats Las Vegas.
You can't buy off unhappiness with pills.
I'm going to see if I can find an inflation calculator.
Yeah, what would $40,000 be?
I'm seeing. Yeah. I know the ladies over on the Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast. So do we talk about the black bra now?
Yes, it's there. It's black.
So Hitchcock did this because before she was kind of the good girl, so she was wearing a white bra. And now that she's done the crime and she's stealing the money, she's wearing black.
Just
she's
like in the Western, the black hats versus the white hats. The good guys versus the bad guys.
I really want to see a Western where it's the white bras versus the black bras. Just that, you can rent those. Like the thing. Oh, like non-sexually, it's not going to do anything for me, but I was just like, oh, okay, okay.
See the shower in the background.
Yeah. And
okay, so I just did a quick inflation calculator. Mm-hmm. So it looks like $40,000 in 1960... would be $346,000 US right now.
So your typical suburban house, nothing fancy.
Well, Pat, what are houses like? Because you guys had a few years ago, you had that bank bust, right? Has the market bounced back yet?
I don't know. I'm not really in the market. I mean, they say it has, but I've also been told now is not a great time to buy a house, so.
Okay, maybe it hasn't quite bounced back yet. So, but like 350,000 American. I mean, we're in Canadian dollars, so that's probably about 500,000 Canadian.
Maybe
that's like a half a million Canadian. That wouldn't be that far off from that.
Wow.
So here she is. She's packed up her troubles in her old kit bag,
mm-hmm.
and she's jumping in her car. She's going to get out of town.
Now, I'm going to talk about the car here. So, this is Janet Leigh, and she's actually the mother of Jamie Lee Curtis. So, I don't know if people knew that or not.
Yeah.
But Janet Leigh was actually in Halloween H2O.
Yes.
And she played the secretary of the school where Jamie Lee Curtis taught. And there's actually a scene where she's leaving for the weekend and she gets into this car and drives away.
Oh, right on.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a little in joke.
I mean,
and of all
she just saw her boss.
Of all the street corners in town, she has her boss walk by the front of her car. She's driving out of town.
Now, did you notice the Christmas decorations on the street?
Oh, no.
I didn't.
Well, there were. And it was a mistake. Hitch sent the second unit to Phoenix to shoot all that footage. Mm-hmm. And they got the Christmas decorations. And that is the sole reason that it's set on December 11th.
Ah. That's cool.
Nice.
Now, the web postings that I follow from the author, is it Ribeiro that wrote The Making of Hitchcock?
Ribeiro.
The Making of Psycho. He also appears in the documentary about the shower scene. He's a very good expert on this film. He calls this frame here where the cop peers in the window the most terrifying scene in the whole film. Where the right here where the cop looks in the window with his mirrored shades, he calls that the most terrifying scene. And I've never really taken it that extreme before, but she's freaked out.
That one there.
She's freaked out because she's got the money in her purse. She's on the run, and suddenly the cops are stopping her. He's stopping her because there's a car abandoned on the highway. Like, he has very innocent reason to stop her, but she's worried that the cops have figured out that she has this money, right?
Yes.
It's so interesting when you get a movie like this. Like, I haven't read the book. Pat, have you read the book?
Yes, actually, I just reread it.
Okay, I haven't read it, so you'll have to tell me how similar they are. But, you know, you get a scene like this where, you know, this is our main character, the movie, and she's done something bad. She's done something illegal. But when I watch this movie, I'm, like, worried for her that she's about to get caught. And it's like, why would I feel this way when she's done something bad? She's stolen money from a company. Naughty, naughty. Right? But I don't want her to get caught. And so this next scene where the cop is following her, where she goes to buy the car and switch her car and whatnot, like, it's really tense because this cop is following her. And the drive that's about to come up with the cop tailing her is, like, really tense.
Yeah, the book covered it in a paragraph or so, saying that she had done it more than once, switched cars more than once to try to just evaporate.
Okay.
But they flesh it out here.
Mm-hmm. And she's hiding the bundle of money with her body. She's very nervous about having to pull her ID out of her purse. Mm-hmm. And he's ever present, staring in the window.
Boy, these cars were so big back then.
I know. Is she anal? Yeah, she's not a good thief.
Mm-hmm. Well, she's not used to it. I get the impression she's never done it before. Yeah. I don't know, like, she's never stolen before. It's just a crime of opportunity.
I think that's what's intimated in the book. Because the character, I mean, she's called Mary in the book, but it's basically, she goes, she admits, you know, she takes it in a moment of madness and all that sort of thing, and then she has the conversation with Norman, and then once she's in the shower, she's kind of committed to, yep, I've done a bad thing, but I'm going to turn around and go and, you know, atone and everything, and then unfortunately she doesn't. I mean, the one thing I wanted to point out about the, you know, the Christmas and she sees a boss at the thing scene, and I'm sure you guys already know this, but people who are listening might not, that scene has been, not parodied, but I would say had a big homage paid to it in one of the biggest films of the 90s, which is Pulp Fiction.
Right.
The Bruce Willis, Ving Rhames, Marcellus Wallace scene when he stops him and he's got the box of donuts and he just turns and it's framed the exact way, except Ving Rhames says and goes,
oh,
motherfucker.
Oh my goodness.
Wonderful.
I never realized that.
That's my, Pulp Fiction's
that
my favorite.
Totally,
that's what he said.
My mind is blown.
I'm going to watch Pulp Fiction later, Chris.
Oh my goodness.
Okay, so a little California stuff here. She was on Highway 99, which does go to Bakersfield, and the long shot just now has a sign that says Bakersfield City Limit. But here, actually, she's in Studio City, California. And that location that she's at is still there. It's changed a bit, but I, you know, I pass by, I genuflect, I go, I just look at it.
So this is a real car dealership on a street corner.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
It's built up. So, like, mm-hmm. well, never mind. Anyway, the point is that it's very close to Universal Studios, so they just drove about a mile.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you guys heard the George Lucas petition where he wants to redo this film and add a CGI yellow charger Bumblebee into this scene and get, what's his name, Perry, what's his name, to be the car salesman?
I haven't heard that.
And then it would take place in Transformers continuity?
That's all above my head. I love how condescending. I love how condescending the salesman is. Oh, there's a woman buying a car. I'm surprised he doesn't say, "Does your husband know you're here?"
Yeah.
I'm in no mood for trouble, lady.
I was trying to place this actor. I didn't have time to look into it, but I know I've seen him on Twilight Zone and stuff recently because I've been watching the old Twilight Zones.
And I've seen him on Perry Mason. I've been watching those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But this scene, too, is like this guy and this character is so awesome because he's like, he's even saying this is the first time that the customers high pressured the salesman, you know, and, you know, I love his line where he's like, "You got your pink slip for this and whatnot." And there's the cop watching. And honestly, every time I watch this movie, I'm surprised that she goes through with the transaction with the cop watching her.
Yeah.
Because then the cop sees her in the new vehicle, you know. So
it's such great character work. You know, this guy's only in 2 minutes, 3 minutes of the whole film, but it just adds this little kind of nuance to him in the same way that, you know, the guy whose $40,000 gets stolen, he gets characterization. It's not just... I really like the salesman.
Mm-hmm. California Charlie.
Yeah.
I think I misspoke earlier. It's probably this car that's in Halloween H2O, not the previous car, because she switches. I forgot about that, but it's the one that she dies in, so it'd be this car here. So
right,
yeah, or not. Yeah, dies and in, but.
I've seen that scene in H2O, and they also in the underscore they have a little bit of the Psycho music.
Yeah,
just they weave it in.
Yep, that's right. Yep. Now, Pat, I want to ask you a question here before we go into this. So this is if this is one of your favorites here, what do you think of the remake with Ving Rhames? Or, yeah, not Ving Rhames.
Vince Vaughn.
Vince Vaughn, sorry. With Vince Vaughn in it. What are your feelings on that?
My ultimate feeling is why it really wasn't necessary to do. I did see it when I was able to go to a free screening because I wasn't going to pay for it on principle.
Mm-hmm.
I did admire how good an imitation it was at times.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really all. That's all I have to say to praise it. I still don't think it was necessary. And also, I think if he was going to copy it from shot to shot like he did so well in most of it, why did he have to change things in the shower scene?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which he did. But the thing I like most about the remake is that the end credits. It goes beyond the car being dragged out of the mud, and it pulls back, and you see the police there, and it just... Because, you know, nowadays they have the long credit crawl, where in 60 they just had the end. So that was fun, because I'd imagine that, and I got to see it. But I'm glad it's mostly forgotten.
I haven't seen it since theaters. I saw it opening weekend, and I haven't seen it since then. So the remake.
There's a cameo coming up here. The mechanic that loads the luggage in a minute here is Don Ross, who is best known for the TV series Dragnet.
Okay.
So a little cameo from an actor that became fairly well known afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm researching on the fly. There is a cameo by Robert Osborne, the Turner Classic movie host, in this film somewhere.
Huh.
A small role.
What?
Yeah, there's a small role. Now, I'm not able to determine exactly what the role is. But that's legit cred right there. If you've got a cameo in Psycho, that's a big deal.
That's
wow.
Legit.
That's crazy.
And there's an awesome cameo at the very, very end of a policeman in uniform. And I'll leave that. I think Pat knows who I'm talking about. I'll leave that till later. See if the other guys can remember who that is.
Yeah, see there.
Chris might be too young.
I don't think Chris will know that cameo. There's a cameo,
at the end
of a policeman in uniform.
I mean, to be fair, when you said, oh, when you saw the Psycho remake, I think, what, did it come out in 98? So yeah, I was 98. Seven. And when he said Dragnet, I genuinely just went, I have no idea what Dragnet is.
Dragnet?
You're not versed enough in American culture
I am not, although to my British family, I'm too immersed, so... God, I love that. This is such an odd thing to say, but I watch this film to relax. I don't know if anyone else does. Like, no, but I'm one of those people who, like, watches horrors and thrillers, and I'm like, oh, this is just relaxing. And then once it's done, I'm like, okay, this is cool. So, but I just, yeah.
I was very impressed with Netflix yesterday when I found this available on Netflix. Mm. I was happy to see that. And Psycho 2 is available.
Ah.
The Perkins 1983 film. And the Vince Vaughn Psycho is available on Netflix in Canada. As is the Bates Motel series that we've talked about on the show before. Yeah.
As far as I know, Netflix here only has Strangers on a Train as their only Hitchcock. So I'm impressed with Canada. Yeah. Again.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, for once, Canada's better than the States. Yeah.
Healthcare. Anyway.
What was that?
This is great. Like, pardon the tangent, but I'm so happy that we've got such a variety of people on the show today. We've got the American influence, we've got the British influence, and the Canadians in the center, kind of like anchoring between the two mega cultures that are, you know, we're stuck in the middle of, between British and American culture, and we absorb it all in, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
There was that joke on that, because I randomly follow a Canadian comedy channel on YouTube, because it's quite funny, and there was a joke a comedian did, which is, Americans think of Canada as America's hat, and Canadians think of Americans as Canada's jockstrap. And for some reason, that genuinely made me full-on laugh, and I was like, okay.
Somebody, I forget who the comedian was, referred to as Canada is the nice apartment above a meth lab.
Yeah.
No offense, Pat.
None taken.
See, we're in Canada, so we get the French influence, so we would have said Jacques Strap.
I did not know yes. There's Jacques any strap. I don't know what's...
Now, she's in a pickle of a dilly of a pickle here.
Yeah.
With the rain
storm. And the rain is a theme that again, in the documentary about the shower scene, some of the experts talk about this rain is a foreshadow to the water in the shower.
Yeah.
And the difficulty that the shower proves to her. And this is rain that she's fighting through. She can't drive properly. She can't see. This is the weight of her crime bearing down on her. This is the emotion that she's going through.
Which is quite appropriate because all of the sort of water sources in the film turn out to be deadly in a way. You know, the rain forces her off the road. It's in the shower that kills her. And then when they're dragging the bog at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So jumping into this scene, we're pulling into the hotel here. And I gotta say, like, I haven't seen this movie in a while. Like, I watched it in prep for this. But when I was watching it the other night, I am just absolutely blown away at how accurately they recreated the set for the TV show.
Like, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is just mind-boggling how accurate a recreation it is.
Now, was the TV show filmed on the same location?
No.
Like, the Psycho House still stands today, doesn't it, in California? Like, as a tourist attraction?
They filmed Bates Motel in Vancouver, up in Canada here.
So, oh, that's so
there's
cool.
Mama Bates.
I love that.
Hi, Mom.
California Gothic is what Hitchcock calls the house.
Yeah. Right.
Also known as Gingerbread Gothic, apparently.
Oh.
And deliberately, the house is a strong vertical structure. The motel is a like a lower, weaker horizontal structure. He was very happy with the comparisons between the architecture of the two buildings.
Okay.
The contrast between the two. So the house really glooms over the hotel. Like, it's very powerful, right?
It dominates.
Anthony Perkins.
And here he comes in the pouring rain, and he never opens his umbrella.
Dirty night.
You have a vacancy. It hangs limply down his side. 12 cabins, 12 vacancies.
We have 12 cabins. 12 of them are available. Yeah. There's your first clue to get a different motel, lady. Get back in your car now.
Yeah, Janet Leigh doesn't have good luck on hotels, if you've ever seen Touch of Evil.
I've seen Touch of Evil once. I actually just saw it recently. That opening sequence, I had heard so many times, and to finally see that movie... You know, I love Orson Welles. Like, there's... To be able to put himself on display, like, as some bad characters in a couple of his movies, you know?
Right here.
Because...
I love... Sorry. Where he hesitates, and he's like, I'll give her room number one.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't know which room to give her.
Anyways, it's closer, in case I want to jerk off to you.
Which they do in the remake, but they don't
really
show
which
that.
I thought
did anyone just notice the newspaper?
Yeah.
It says it's okay on the top of it.
Oh, really?
I think so. Unless I've just completely saw it, but when there's like a little cutback when he's looking for the key and looks back and she's got the newspaper sticking straight out of her bag. And I swear it's on the top of it, it says it's okay.
Well,
I didn't know. I'm you know.
It's stuffy in here. Yeah. That's my favorite line. It's a bit like taxidermy in here.
Oh, I never thought of that.
This is a very funny line, too. Bates Motel envelopes if you want to make your friends jealous. He cannot say the word bathroom. Now, this happens in the 1983 Psycho 2. He cannot say the phrase, he cannot tell the guest that this is the bathroom because he's so nervous about, he knows what the bathroom is all about.
In the sequels? Especially in Psycho 2.
Mm. Yeah.
I haven't seen Psycho 2. I've seen like half of Psycho 3, and I haven't seen Psycho 4. So I'm looking forward to getting to those when we get a chance.
I just read the novel Psycho 2. Has nothing to do with the movie of the same name.
Is it a sequel to the book?
Yes, by Robert Black.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that he wrote a sequel to it.
Yeah. He wrote it around the time that the second movie was made. I think just for a tie-in, but it's a completely different story.
Maybe he didn't like what they did with the movie, so he's like, I better write my own thing.
Yeah, maybe.
Because like 2001, they wrote the movie in conjunction with the book, but for some reason the book takes place at Saturn and the movie takes place at Jupiter. But then when Arthur C. Clarke wrote 2010, he made it take place at Jupiter, like the movie, which is kind of weird.
It's kind of like what's going on with The Shining and Dr. Sleep. You know, the Stephen King stuff.
I know.
Because,
like The Shining is a terrible adaptation of the book, but it's an amazing film. But this, I haven't read Dr. Sleep, but the sequel, like with the trailer just recently dropped as we're recording this here, takes heavily influence from this Kubrick film. In there's music and, you know, like they got the hotel structure and everything.
Well, that's the thing. They use images, they use a lot. So it kind of makes you think, has Stephen King kind of seen the appeal and gone, okay, so which stuff is actually truest to my version of The Shining? Because Dr. Sleep is a direct sequel to the book, and it's very specific about it's a sequel to the book and not the Kubrick film. So,
is it a bad idea to wrap $40,000 in a newspaper and leave it on
in
the table?
In this case, yes.
Is that a bad idea?
He'll never see it. He'll never see his tip. If you're going to leave a tip at a motel, you should have it plain.
So I love that time has gone by and now the rainstorm has stopped and like it's just dripping, right? Because like I can just smell it, and I love rainstorms when they're done and they're slowing down. I love the smell of that kind of rain, and I can actually just I smell it when I watch
Petrical.
This movie.
So Mother is yelling at him right now up at the house,
mm-hmm.
but she's dead. So how is she yelling?
Spoilers, Tom.
Well, I'm sorry.
So I picture him, like, he's just sitting there. He's obviously going, blah, 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 blah. Blah, 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 blah. Like, he's like
doing characters.
It's Sméagol and Gollum. He's turning over one shoulder and going, no, I don't know what's going on. And then turn back going, like, ah, oh, you're a worthless piece of shit, Norman. And it's just, it's like, it's, you know. It's like that.
Mother!
I'm going to have to give a language warning at the start of this, because I'm not going to go in and edit all our swears.
Darn it.
That when we opened the chat officially, there was at least a couple of like F-bombs and all that sort of thing, so...
Just like Hitchcock, we refuse to deal with censorship.
Yeah.
So I guess we could talk about now. So he's about to serve her dinner and whatnot. We could talk something fun. So Hitchcock had a big promotion going on with this movie. And he had an arrangement with movie theaters where if the movie started, normally movie theaters would just let people come in at whatever time. But for Psycho, they had a huge ad campaign that if you were late, you would not be allowed into the movie. And the reason for that is because Janet Leigh's character dies. And, like, Janet Leigh was a big actress at the time. And to kill off such a major actress was unheard of at this time. You wouldn't have gotten somebody so major to do this role normally. So he had the whole thing, and it's like, don't talk about this movie. You know, there's posters of him pointing at his watch, and it says something like, if you're late, you won't be admitted, and things like that. So it was a big, big thing that if you were late, because then if you came in and were expecting Janet Leigh, and she wasn't there because she was already dead, well, then you wouldn't know what was going on.
But good for him for teaching the audience how to have some respect for the film, the proper etiquette. You get there in time for the film, you watch the whole film.
Yeah.
Because apparently at the time, it was more like a newsreel environment where people just came and went all day long. They didn't care. They walked in the middle of the movie.
I could just picture Hitchcock nowadays if he had Twitter. Like, he would just lose his fucking mind on people for spoiling stuff.
And I love all the birds. Marion Crane and A Room Full of Birds. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of bird stuff going on with all the taxidermy talk.
I've seen that owl. There was a screening here in L.A., and Universal Props loaned a few things, and one of them was the owl. It was under glass. It was so cool.
Wow.
Oh, nice.
You eat like a bird, and later you'll get taxidermied like a bird.
Yeah. Falsity. He was so good. He brought so much to this role.
My hobby is stuffing things. Oh, dear.
I think this is his last black and white movie. Is that correct, Pat?
I don't know for sure, but I would imagine so.
And he had done some color films at this point, but the reason that they decided to film this in black and white is because of the murder and showing the blood on screen. Oops, did that thing just pop up? So, because of the blood that you see on screen, they didn't want to show it red.
Hitchcock talks about how much he hates blood. He doesn't like seeing blood. And yes, he felt that showing the blood in black and white would be less drastic or less realistic.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a movie that Perkins starred in for Orson Welles called The Trial. And I don't know what year that was. That was in black and white. So whenever that was, you know, if that was after this, it might have been. But probably not.
Okay, yeah, because I'm looking through his filmography here. So I Confess was 1953, and that was black and white. And then Dial M for Murder was color, but also 3D. Rear Window was color. To Catch a Thief was color. Trouble with Harry, color. Man Who Knew Too Much, color. Wrong Man was black and white. Vertigo, color. North by Northwest, color. And then Psycho was in black and white. This one here, I'm not sure why he would have done The Wrong Man in black and white, I guess, then.
I think he did it that way to get more of a documentary-style feel to it.
Okay.
Because that was... The whole point of that was that it was a real story, and he was using the real locations, and he was trying to make it as authentic as possible.
Yeah.
It might also be that he had to use a lower budget because they didn't bank on it. Paramount hated this idea. They wouldn't pay for Psycho at all. That's why he had to use his own money, and that's why he did it so cheap.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Well, he produced the film for $850,000 using his television crew.
Yeah, because he thought, you know, they They get things done quickly and cheaply, so...
Hitchcock earned $15 million from the initial release of this film. He became the richest, most famous film director in the world after this came out.
Wow.
And like you said, the studio didn't want to produce it. It was the best investment Hitchcock ever made for an outlay of $800,000 is what he paid to produce the film.
And he shot it at Universal. And at that point, he just moved in. From then on, he was Universal all the way.
Mm-hmm. His next film after this was The Birds. So
yes. Mm-hmm. That would be fun to do a commentary on,
yeah,
too.
Well, maybe I'd bit.
There
maybe
are
I'd
crows in my backyard that I can hear right now.
Could be.
This scene is, by itself, brilliant. It's beautifully written. It's beautifully acted. And it's the first interaction that Marion has had with someone who is like her. They're very much alike, the two of them. They're both in their private traps, as he says. And she's realizing that she went through some madness and she didn't know what she was doing. Mm-hmm. That's the difference. He doesn't.
I like that. Yeah, because, yeah, like, she's clearly, you know, second-guessing herself and what she did and realizing that it was bad, and so...
I like the art on the walls. I've only just noticed that this time around, but a lot of it is this religious nudity punishment kind of artwork. It's kind of hinting a bit, I guess.
In the 7852 documentary about the shower scene, they talk about the painting which he removes from the wall, and it's a famous old painting of two men basically groping a naked female. That's, you know, nowhere near the proper explanation of the history of that painting over his shoulder there. That's the painting that he removes to have the peephole hidden in the wall.
Okay.
So even that, what could be a throwaway prop of a framed painting has very deep significance. So Hitchcock took his time in choosing that painting.
Well, then you've got the giant, I can't tell if it's a, you know, an owl or a giant, you know, stuffed thing, but it almost looks as though it's aimed right down the barrel of the camera. Mm-hmm. And then you've got, you know, like the little bird there looking at, it's like it's looking at Norman looking at Marion. Love how it's just all framed. This is such a cool sequence.
Yeah.
And her the acting right here is amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Their expressions.
Yeah, he's very, has a determined pace in this film, you know, like he's very restrained. Like, this is definitely a work that he couldn't have done early in his career, I don't think. Like, it takes practice as a director to get to a point where you're able to make a film like this and The Birds, you know, like he's really at the height of his craft at this point, you know, making stuff that's, it's not slow, but it's paced. Yeah. You know, and even like something with The Birds in his next film, to be making a horror movie with no score, after making a horror movie with such a groundbreaking score.
Yeah.
You know, like one of the things about the score in this film, before we get into the murder scene here, is that the score is done, I believe it's exclusively on strings. And up until this point, strings have been used for like love and romance. And this is the first example of strings being used to convey terror and like the slashing sound, the like that was a very new and brave thing to do with a film score that Bernard Herrmann did for this.
Yeah, he wanted to complement the black and white by having black and white music, so to speak. And it's just brilliant. And Hitch did not want any music over the shower scene. But Benny Herrmann composed it, played it for him, and changed his mind. But I often wonder if that was also the reason that Hitch didn't have any music in The Birds. Maybe it's like to get the final say on not having music in major murder scenes.
Yeah. I haven't seen The Birds in so long. I got to watch that again. I was wondering about watching this with Aubrey, but I'm like, you know, I think the death scenes are still probably a little bit too much for her.
She's eight?
She's eight. She's almost nine. I mean, we've seen Jaws and stuff, but... You know, I'm not sure if this... I think I'll still hold off on this one here. I want to watch The Birds again, though. I think that might be okay for her.
I asked my wife last night if she wanted to watch one of the Psycho films with me as I was doing my day of research, and she's like, well, I don't want to have nightmares. <I'm> like...
So what do you guys think of Anthony Perkins as Norman Bates in this? Do you think he was a good choice? What do you think? Pat, we'll start with you.
I can't imagine anybody else. I think he was the perfect choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the kind of role you can only do once.
Yeah.
I mean, because somebody else who was more established and famous for another kind of role might not have been able to do it. The reason it worked so well is because it was totally against type.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to it with so many ideas that Hitchcock liked. His whole thing about being a bird and eating the candy corn the way a chicken would, that was all Perkins' idea.
Oh, wow. So when you say against role, like, I don't really know him. The only other thing that I think I know him from is The Trial, and I just saw that recently. But watching that really made me think of Psycho quite a bit, like, probably because it's black and white and it's right around this age for him. Like, it was very close to the filming of this.
Right. Well, he had been kind of a teeny bopper, matinee idol actor.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of fluff, the one serious movie he made...
Sorry, guys. Can I interrupt for a second?
Yeah, go ahead.
In the Vince Vaughn film, they have the sound effect here of him masturbating as he does the people, which was totally inappropriate and I think really detracted from the scene. We don't know what Perkins is doing here right now, but suffice to say what the peeking into the shower from the hole in the wall is horrific enough. We don't need other details. We don't need other information.
Mm-hmm. I've got my own appreciation for Gus Van Sant's version, and I have my own appreciations for Gus Van Sant. But we'll talk about that when we get to the remake. So I think it's interesting what he did myself.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that another time. Sorry, where you were talking about his works here, Anthony Perkins' works.
Yeah, he was in the... Well, he and Tab Hunter were friends, and I think they had an affair. They were both closeted actors. And Hitch knew the rumors, and that worked in Perkins' favor as to getting the role.
Mm-hmm.
Because he felt, I guess, that he could play a mama's boy a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Perkins did such a good job on this, and then for years he regretted it because he was so typecast he couldn't get work.
Mm.
And then, of course, he went back and embraced it with the sequels. And
Yeah, I think when you have something like that, you almost have to embrace it at that point. Like, Psycho 2 came so, like, over 20 years later. I think it was, like, 22 or 23 years later.
22 years, yeah.
Psycho 2 came out. Like, that's kind of crazy with the delay in that.
I was so excited. I saw that opening day. It was just so thrilling to see the set in color. And
Now, again, everyone's talked about this. We show the flushing toilet for the first time.
Yeah.
Viewers of films have seen a toilet flushing. And people talk about how, to Hitchcock as a Victorian-era man, the bathroom is a sacred place that you don't talk about what happens in there. And to show a flushing toilet was very innovative and very against what the viewers were used to, which to the modern day viewers, like, what's the big deal? It's a toilet.
Yeah.
And he tricked the censors because he wrote into the script that it was a significant part of the story, that later Lila and Sam would find a clue in that toilet.
Mm.
And here we go. Here we go.
Yeah. That's such a great shot of the camera up into the water. I love that.
I've always wondered what happens to the soap and the wrapper. You never see them. Uh-huh. You hear her taking the wrapper off.
Well, the soap could evaporate.
Okay, here we go. The ultimate scene.
Oh, my God.
Oh, the framing is beautiful. Look at this shot.
Oh, my God.
This is so beautiful.
So. The audience is going, what? Wait, the
what,
F?
What,
the scream.
Ah!
Okay, and we never see the knife enter the body. Not once. I love it. And it's all in your mind. Yep. You see nothing. It's great. Like, even there, right? You don't see it going in. And this is all chocolate syrup.
Yeah.
So that's what they use to get it dark on the screen.
52 edits in 3 minutes.
Okay, so I'm going to ask the challenging question that I hope that you guys can answer here. Okay, so because they talk about it at the end, so we all know that that's actually Norman Bates here, who's come in. He's dressed as his mom. He's gone absolutely nuts, and he's got this split personality going on. But the police officer at the end tries to explain that it's not, he's not being a transvestite, because he's just dressing up as his mom. So they start talking about these other terms and stuff like this, and I don't know. What do you guys know about that?
Just what you said.
You know, I don't think it is what, you know, because obviously the way that we look at gender nowadays is very different than it was, you know, nearly 50 years ago. But to be honest, looking at what they actually say is, you know, a transvestite is someone who, you know, adopts clothing of a different gender to, you know, if it's for a sexual thing or if it's some kind of gender expression thing and it's like a long-term whatever, which isn't too far away from the truth. You know, I don't think it's, you know, if you can look into like a queer-coded reading of it, it's not, you know, what we would say is transgenderism, because he's not becoming his mother in the sense of, or he's not becoming female to achieve something or something within him. It's trauma. It's, you know, a severe case of dissociative identity disorder, where the mind's fragmented and it's basically gone, okay, to deal with this trauma of a very unhealthy relationship and to save your mother, because you can't reconcile with the fact that you killed her, she basically then takes on a little alter, I think it's referred to, in his mind. So psychologically it actually holds up pretty well to what he's still floating around in the diagnostic manuals.
Yeah, and is in fact it's rather than a sexual expression, it's a sexual repression, because his mother keeps him from expressing his sexual desires.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's, you know, he feels, you know, a natural attraction, and it's, you know, whatever it is for him, and the part of him that feels guilt, and even in the book, it's implied that when they eventually raid the house, it's like in the last chapter, they say they find books on, like, Satanism and necrophilia and incest and that sort of thing. So it's kind of implying there was a incestuous component to the relationship somehow. So, I would guess so. She's the only real figure in his life. You know, whether or not it was, like, physical or if it was some kind of weird emotional relationship or something. But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if that's a big part of it. Obviously, they couldn't, even in 1960, they couldn't talk about it. They couldn't go around saying, oh, it's because of this and because of this, you know. But,
because, like, I wonder, because, you know, with Anthony Perkins being gay, you know, and, like, at this time, being gay and talking about these issues and stuff wasn't really discussed in 1960. So, like, I wonder, did people interpret that Norman Bates was gay because he dressed up as a woman, because Anthony Perkins was gay? Like, I wonder what the general public impression of him was watching this film.
If you don't mind, there's a quick quote here from Perkins. He said that he told Hitchcock he was tired of being a young romantic lead. He wanted to do more interesting parts, but he was worried about playing a homicidal transvestite. So, to me, the transvestite thing is just that he's playing his mother. He's becoming his mother. I don't think he's transvestite in the sexual sense that's what he likes to do in his bedroom. Like, he just,
and that could very well be why they made sure to explain that in the very long psychiatrist speech at the end.
I mean, I can understand Anthony Perkins' situation in that sense, because, you know, at least from, you know, a UK perspective in the 60s, you know, homosexuality was still illegal for the best part of the decade, and it was still classed as a mental disorder for many years. It was, you know, there was Stonewall, there was all these kind of shifts towards LGBT acceptance and to gay rights and all that sort of thing. But, you know, for
this is before
exactly, you know, talking about a closeted actor who's made, you know, and he is amazing in the role. And I think, you know, whoever said it might have been Pat, said that he's, you know, the only person who could have done this, because it's I would say the kind of the queerness at the core of him as an actor really helps inform this. And I don't think there's many actors who could kind of do as good of a job, you know. And you'd struggle even nowadays to find someone who's willing to kind of take all that on. Because in a way it's quite soul-bearing of performance. It's incredible. So no matter what people think about it, you cannot say anything really about his performance, because he gives it his all. And it's a, you know, a career highlight.
And like he said, he previously had played a young romantic lead, and so his characters on the screen were heterosexual. So he was risking professional damage, professional stereotyping as a gay actor that could hurt his income for the rest of his career in that environment of the day, the way they were treated in the day, right? But he got stereotyped as Norman, and like it you know, he made the sacrifice for this character, for this film, of stereotyping himself for the rest of his life as this actor, and for our benefit. Like he left it all on the screen for us to enjoy this character. And it may have hurt him in the long run as an actor professionally, but good for him. Like, it was an amazing performance.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that fortunately recently has started becoming less of an issue, but all the way through the, you know, the 80s, 90s, 2000s, I mean, the 90s, I remember it was Rupert Everett, British actor, who said when he came out, his career pretty much dried up. You know, he was very steady, he was kind of a household name for supporting roles and comedies and all that sort of thing, but when he was kind of openly gay, that kind of stuff dried up and it really impacted his career. You know, and speaking to the modern day, there's an actor called Luke Evans who you might have seen if you've seen the recent Beauty and the Beast remake, or that Dracula Untold film that came out a few years ago, or like a bunch of different films and everything. And he was an openly gay actor in the 90s, but who then went back into the closet when he, you know, in like the 2000s, and was, you know, oh, he's been in a long-term relationship with his female publicist and that sort of thing. And even he admitted a couple of years back, he was like, no, it was a full-on doctored, faked relationship because my career had started to pick up a bit. You know, and now he's openly gay and he's doing posts about Pride Month and everything, and that's great. But, you know, that's still really recent. There's still a big, you know, a glass closet that a lot of actors feel pushed into.
Yeah, if Hitch was making movies today, I think he might have cut himself off from a lot of good material, because not just this, but Strangers on a Train in particular. Yeah. Robert Walker, you know, played an obvious homosexual, and then there was Rope.
Yes.
With Hitchcock was fascinated by sexual deviations. Yeah. He wasn't judging. He was fascinated by it.
Mm-hmm. People talk about the shower scene and the impression that it made. And, you know, as modern, you know, as we sit watching the film today, it's a pretty impressive scene. But this is a summary of what the filmmaker Peter Bogdanovich said. The Psycho is the moment in movies when, for the first time, movies were not safe. He remembers coming out of the screening feeling like he'd been raped or something, or mugged. It was terrifying. Nobody recovered from that shower scene. Mm-hmm. You couldn't hear the soundtrack because the audience was screaming through the entire 45 seconds. He never heard the violins. And the scriptwriter, Joseph Stefano, recalls, I saw people grab at each other, howling, screaming, reacting like six-year-olds at a Saturday matinee. So that is that moment in history. That shower scene is referred to as one of the most important films in the history of cinema. One of the most important scenes in film history right there. And
well, the reason why is because, like, this is one of, I don't know if there's a lot of these movies prior to this, but this is a gear shift movie. Like, you are going into this movie and you're watching this, and if you don't know the book, right, like this, you're expecting one type of movie because she's robbed, and then all of a sudden your main character that you've been following is dead, right? And so this movie's a whole other thing. And even here, like him just throwing the money in the trunk like we just saw, like you're expecting him to find that money. Like there's certain expectations that you have, and even still watching to this day, you expect to have certain types of expectations fulfilled, and they're not. Like the money is no longer important, right? Like the money that she stole is no longer important and doesn't really play a factor. Yeah, they're kind of still looking for her, and when we get to the sister and whatnot, but he doesn't find the money, so that it doesn't really do anything. Here he is, he's dumping the car into a swamp.
The crime film would have him kill her for the money, but that's not why he killed her. And I love the license plate, NFB, not finding body. And how many bodies and cars are in this swamp? And like, who picks a swamp to dump a car? Like, don't we have a river or a lake?
I mean, they do mention it at the very end, don't they? Say, oh, there's a couple of the girls who went missing in the area.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
See, and the other thing is with this scene. So he's dumped this car into this swamp, and then again, our expectations. Like, I don't know about you guys, but when I watch it and the car doesn't go down, like, I'm like, oh my goodness, what's he going to do if this car doesn't go down? And it's like, why would I care? That would mean he would get caught easier. He's just murdered somebody. Yeah. You know, so again,
we're rooting
Hitchcock
for him.
Is such a paced director, and even with how much time he spent with this character disposing of this body, cleaning up the crime scene, like, now all of a sudden, this is our main character, and we care about what happens to him. Mm-hmm. But he's just killed someone. Like, this movie is so well done.
Hello?
Hello?
Did we lose something?
I just thought Brandon's audio went out for a second.
Oh, yeah.
Brandon, can you hear us?
Because we can't hear you.
Okay, we'll leave the film rolling for continuity, for timing.
Okay. Yeah.
Of course.
Brandon?
Brandon, can you hear me?
Okay, let's just give Brandon a chance to talk here. Okay, so we're talking about, you know, the bodies in the dump.
Yeah.
The bodies in the lake is in the swamp. Yeah. And now what's happening is the sister shows up.
Yes.
And it's turned into a missing woman story. There's a missing person. And I love the part in this hardware store where the character, like, he's living the poor life in the back of his dad's hardware store that he inherited. They could never get married because why would she want to live in the hardware store with him?
Yeah.
So this, and the young man running the till is very interested in the conversation.
Yeah.
Don't you have lunch to eat? No, I'm good. I brought lunch. Well, go eat your lunch. Yeah, so get lost.
Run out and eat it. That's a great line.
Oh, my God. I do like how this day, you know, they're brought together just for marrying everything, but I do love this very spiky odd couple pairing for like the last third of the film, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the detective walks in.
Yeah.
So that, okay, to be clear, why is the detective involved? The only reason the detective is involved because there's 40 grand missing.
Yeah.
Exactly.
They're not so much worried about the dead woman. They want that $40,000 back.
Right. My name is Arbogast, friend. And that's, it's partly Mr. Lowry's influence, because he cares about Marion and hopes that he can get her out of trouble. If it was just up to the Texan, he would just, you know, press charges right away.
Mm-hmm. $40,000. The rich Texan Tom.
Yeah. So there's Vera Miles, who had at one time been, she was the original choice of Hitch for Vertigo.
Right.
And she committed the sin of getting pregnant with a third child.
Well, that would not do back in the day.
Right. Well, not for Hitch. He was like, how dare she? So but she was still under contract, and he still had to use her one more time, so he put her in this. And yes, her character is rather sultry, but still, you don't see much love lost between her and the director.
No.
Yeah.
And back, you know...
Do we have Brandon back?
There we go.
Oh,
so,
I think I heard
him. Yeah. So, what would the modern-day detective be doing to try and track this woman down? They'd be checking her social media. They'd be checking her credit cards.
Hey, guys, yes. I'm back here.
And if you watch...
Hey!
If you watch Law & Order, they'd be checking to see if she drove through the transit tunnel.
Yeah.
As her car did the transit tunnel.
They'd be tracking the GPS or, like, the cell towers on any phone calls she made, or...
But this is the old days, so they're walking around town asking people. Yeah.
Excellent. I've been following along. Sorry, listeners. I've been having troubles with my computer, and when my microphone suddenly detaches from my computer somehow, it stops my Audacity, and so I had to start a second file, but... Sorry, listeners. Apologize for the error.
What candy do you think he's eating? I've always...
It's candy corn.
Oh, so what is candy corn? I've genuinely never noticed.
They're those triangle-shaped things that are like orange on top, and then white, and then yellow.
We don't have them over here, so...
Oh.
I don't eat them very often. I don't really like them, but, you know, now, I know what they are.
Him munching on these candies in this scene... is the tension that he's feeling from being visited by the detective.
Yeah.
He's nervously chewing, he's nervously eating.
I suppose it also frames him back in kind of the child, like the innocence. He's there, like a child eating like a bit of a pick and mix, that sort of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah, he's not drinking beer and smoking, he's having this candy corn.
Well, yeah, he's there just like, with, you know, like a little candy treat, and he's like, oh, yeah, yeah, I'll help, all that sort of thing, but...
Yeah, you're right. He would be smoking a cigarette or drinking a beer if he was a mature adult, right? Emotionally mature.
Well.
Arbogast. What a name.
Arbogast.
Yeah. When Sam starts yelling, he's like, Arbogast! Arbogast! And it echoes. I love it.
Yeah, it's a great name.
See, when I watch this movie, you know what I think here, Chris? I'm thinking, where's that girl from the TV show with the oxygen tank? What's she doing?
Oh, this is because I love Emma DeCody. She's my favorite character on Bates Motel. So I'm like, okay, yes, I want to know where she is, but...
At this time.
not this time around. One day we will cover the rest of Bates Motel, because we did series...
One. We did season one.
Was it just season one we did? Yeah.
That's all we did, yeah. And then you spoiled season five for me. Thanks a lot.
I didn't spoil... No, I didn't. No, I didn't. I made a tiny comment, and you were like, don't tell me anything, and I didn't.
And yes, you did.
No, I didn't.
I love you, brother. Didn't.
You didn't listen, tell him Norma dies, did you?
No, he says that some... I don't want to say it, because...
It was a very minor character, and all I said is, oh, you find out what happens to them. I didn't say...
They come running around the corner of the building, and I'm like, what?
Like, the first opening shot of Series 5 is just that character running around, and I'm like, ah! There we go. No,
But that's interesting, though, is that I do actually, like, watching this time, I do think of... Because I've only seen the first three seasons of Bates Motel. I never did never got around to finishing it. But I'm like, I do think about... You know, what's her name? Not Vera Miles. DeFarminga. Vera Farminga.
Vera Farminga, yeah.
Yeah, and I think about the guy from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, right?
Freddie Highmore,
right, as these characters.
Yeah.
Because that show did such a good job. It's so over the top and ridiculous sometimes, but it was fun.
That camera shot of Norman's neck as he's chewing, that is so nerve-wracking and so annoying.
Yeah.
And it just shows the tension that he's going through. Talking to the detective.
Yeah. Freddie Highmore was very well cast.
Oh, yeah. Perfect.
I mean, don't get me wrong, Vera Farmiga is very good as well, but when I watch this, I think of Freddie Highmore as well now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, that was... Because it's the same, like, level. And he's doing... he's basically doing a similar character, but, like, the good version on that show he's doing called The Good Doctor, but it's just, it's... Oh.
We should, I haven't seen The Good Doctor yet.
I've only seen one episode. Because I, it's one of those where it's like, oh, we'll show you a free episode, and if you like it, you can subscribe. And I'm like, no, I'm okay. Well, I don't
I
like
think
it that
we
much.
Should do a petition, a good petition, and that we should get a remake of Psycho with Freddie Highmore. What do you think?
I mean,
I wouldn't say no.
Yeah. Wouldn't say no, but then it see that'd be the interesting thing. And if someone on Twitter after the episode comes out wants us to give us like their fan cast of who they would have, so if Freddie Highmore is Norman, you know, who would be Norma if you're gonna have like flashbacks or anything? Who would be, you know, Marion? Who would be Sam? Who would be Lila? Who'd be Arbogast? Give us, you know, all that kind of stuff. Because I'd be genuinely interested to see who people pick.
Mm. That'd be interesting.
Yeah. God, sorry, I just love this scene. Because they're both clearly aware what the other person's doing.
Yeah.
But they're neither getting an inch, and neither of them are really... They both walk away, and it's a complete stalemate.
Yeah, this guy's such a great private detective, because he's got him grilled, and he's, like, not letting up. But he's not acting aggressive.
No.
He's just asking the questions, but he's not letting up.
Yeah.
Oh, he's you forgot about that. He seems to have forgot about this. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. He seems to sense right away. I mean, look at the way he walked into the hardware store and how aggressive he was at first. And how film noir he was at first. And here, he picks up on Norman's character and he immediately fills the father image role.
Yeah.
Getting him to trust him.
Mm-hmm. Which is a role that's absent. That's empty in his life.
Yeah.
He has no father figure.
So, I understand that they did the scene as scripted, and it was fine, and then the two of them said, Mr. Hitchcock, can we do it again because we've been improvising, and they did it again, and it seemed a bit more natural, and that's the take that we have. I haven't compared it to the actual script yet. I recently got the actual script.
Ooh, the actual script? Wow.
Yeah, from eBay. It's a copy of a million copies, so it's kind of dark on certain pages. But it's it's interesting.
Excellent.
Does the script have handwritten notes by Hitchcock of what he wanted for lunch that day?
No.
Got to go.
No, but it still has her as Mary, not Marion. So it's...
Yeah. He almost looks like a priest for him like that. You know, like the dark and there's like the hint of the white collar and everything. It's made me think.
Right here?
Yeah, a little bit. Like with the dog collar thing. I mean, I don't think it's intentional, but it just... He looks a bit priesty, I guess. Mm. I don't know if it's some kind of innocence connotation thing or trustworthiness.
Or just preppy.
Yeah.
I'm not capable of being fooled, not even by a woman. Because women wouldn't be good at that? I don't know.
She might have fooled me, but she didn't.
Because of what his mother has always told him about women.
Mm-hmm.
They will fool you and con you.
Well, Pat, why don't we take a second? Why don't you tell us a little bit? You're involved with the Hitchcock group on Facebook, right?
Yes, Alfred Hitchcock Geek. Mm-hmm. Joel Guns is the geek. Elizabeth Carlin and I are the assistant geeks, I guess. And, I've learned a lot since joining up with them. First of all, I was very honored that he asked me to be the third person. I really need to step up my contribution because I haven't been doing too much lately on it, but neither have the other two. But Joel and I have just gotten to be really good friends. I mean, I've always wanted to meet someone else who knew these films the way I do, and so we just, you know, we don't live in the same city or anything, but when we do get together, it's a lot of fun. And he has made me realize and appreciate the art in Hitchcock's films. And I don't mean the art of film. I mean the artwork that is in, like we were just talking about, the painting on the wall. See, I never studied art. Joel has. He has written extensively on his actual website, not the Facebook portion of it, but his actual blog about the fact that Hitchcock was an art collector and that, you know, nothing was on the wall in a Hitchcock set that was accidental.
He's in a payphone booth.
But yeah, it's I recommend anyone listening to go on Facebook or on the web to find Alfred Hitchcock Geek. And if you do, I'll write more because I haven't written enough.
How long have you been involved with them?
I'd say 3-4 years now, maybe longer.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, time's going so fast.
Time goes by. What is this thing he's in?
What is that strange box with a telephone in it?
What is that? Where's his cell phone?
Yeah. I think I saw one on Superman.
Featured very prominently in Birds, the payphone.
Yes.
And the technology of the day. Mm-hmm. This is how he talked to other people.
Sam Loomis. So I wonder if it's the same Sam Loomis as this is in Halloween.
I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, it's the old thing, isn't it, that the character in Halloween's named after the Psycho character.
Yeah.
Which is nice, because it just implies that after the events of this, Sam kind of thought, maybe there's something in this psychiatry business. And, like, retrained, and then 18 years later, it all goes horribly wrong.
He
ages really quickly.
We're actually seeing the other end of the motel for probably the first time. Yep. Norman's down in the other rooms.
Well, we saw this in season one of Bates Motel already.
Yeah. This is all just a big flashback, really, so...
Yeah. So,
there was a series... I'm sorry,
I was going to go on a tangent. Go right ahead.
Well, my tangent is that there was a series that started production in 1960 and ran for a few years... called Boris Karloff's Thriller.
Yep.
It was an anthology horror show that Boris Karloff would introduce each episode. And one of the first episodes used The House and Motel.
Wow.
And it freaked me out because I'm watching this show and there's the Psycho House. It scared the shit out of me. But at the time, it was just a standing set, and I guess Psycho hadn't been released yet. They didn't think anyone would notice.
I know the show, but I've never seen it myself. So, the tangent I was going to go on there is I like how they sometimes have connected universes and whatnot. You know, like they'll like make a reference of a character in some completely different movie or something like that, and it makes you think that they're connected somehow. My favorite is if you've ever seen the movie Fringe, the TV show Fringe.
Oh, I love that show.
The doctor, I'm bad with names, but the crazy dad doctor guy. Walter Bishop makes a reference to a Dr. Jacoby, right? And he's actually wearing the glasses at one time where they're like red and blue, like 3D glasses. And he's like, I have glasses like this, like my colleague Dr. Jacoby. And the brilliance of that is one of two things. Either it takes place in the same continuity as Twin Peaks, because that's where Dr. Jacoby's from. Or else, Walter Bishop is so insane that he thinks that this television show character is a colleague of his, right? So,
I have recorded a few episodes, and I'm a host on a couple of episodes of a podcast that's coming out called Observing the Pattern.
Yeah, I had to pull out of that one.
Yeah.
I don't expect those to be released for another 3 years. Tony is insane.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Is a significant bit of cinematography, the staircase climb.
Oh, I love this.
And the camera angle and the angel view camera here.
The bird's eye view of this attack is incredible.
This is amazing. This is stellar.
And there's a lot of work went into this few minutes right here.
Mm-hmm. I love this. It's amazing at how they did to get him down the stairs. But here this goes.
There's a little bit of
this is where vertigo. I thought, I'm like, okay, this is probably a bit too much for Aubrey.
This made me giggle the first time because he's like pinwheeling. Mm-hmm. But then.
Now, there's apparently another cut that's coming out on Blu-ray that extends that death scene.
Oh.
Right?
Okay.
There's like a. I don't know if it's like a British TV version. I wish I had it off the top of my head. But it actually shows the knife go up and down a couple times, and it was edited for this theatrical release. But it like made it to some TV version. And it's coming out on Blu-ray.
I think it might already be out. It's Something like that, a big special box set is available in England or a foreign market or something. I know it costs a lot of euros, so I haven't bought it yet. But I hope to. Because it's supposed to have some more stuff in the shower scene, too, which would be amazing.
I really recommend that documentary 7852 about the shower scene for anybody who hasn't seen it.
It's wonderful.
Very good.
I love the chiaroscuro, if that's what you call it, in this scene. That just the shadow and the light and those rakes behind her.
Mm.
I don't know if it means anything, but it's just so beautiful.
I don't.
Arbogast. Arbogast.
I'm back. My mic unhooked again.
We didn't even notice you were gone.
Okay, sorry, listeners. I don't know why I'm having so much trouble with my computer today.
Arbogast.
Good. Yeah, Arbogast. Brandon, stop talking. Nobody noticed.
Arbogast.
So is the swamp, like, on the same property as the hotel?
Yeah.
Yes, like that's my impression.
Yeah.
And living in Southern California, I have a hard time wrapping my head around the idea that a swamp could exist anywhere. But this isn't necessarily Southern California. This is more central. He didn't come back here. Sam. There is no Fairvale for anyone who wonders.
Only the old lady at home.
That's not the name of the town in Bates Motel, is it?
Should be, yeah.
Is it Fairvale?
Hmm.
Okay, well, I'll have to double check.
Apparently there's a scene with the two of them that was cut where they're just reflecting on the loss of Marion and maybe even starting to fall in love, but we don't want to see a love story. We want to get to the bottom.
I get a big kick out of the fact that they're at the sheriff's house.
Yeah.
And he just shows up. Well, let me put on my bathrobe.
Putting on a robe in an annoyed way.
And the because
it is pretty late.
The sheriff's wife is so helpful here. She's hilarious. Yeah.
She's like the wife in Frenzy. She's like, she's helpful, but she's not really meaning to be. She's just being friendly and just like, oh yes, the murder's this and psychopath's this. And it's the kind of aesthetic I want to live by, which is just kind of very cheerful, but also like, oh, murder.
Yeah, do your reporting around dinner time. It'll make it nicer.
It's just like, come on, sit down. I'll make some eggs, and then you can show me the crime scene photos. Come on.
No,
we got to that other
that's in the last minute.
You're talking about yet?
Final minute.
Oh, okay.
So
that is apparently being a sheriff is a 24-hour job, and he doesn't mind. And this is, he's got open office hours in his living room.
The sheriff's eyebrows are amazing.
Now, is this the same sheriff as from Bates Motel?
Is this supposed to be Nestor Carbonell?
The guy from Lost.
Maybe? I don't know.
Was there a Sheriff Chambers in that at all? Or anyone named Chambers?
I don't know.
I'm not good with names. Romero was the name of the sheriff.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so not the same.
There might be, but Bates Motel does really mess around with the... It remixes stuff, so...
Mm-hmm. So that's John McIntyre. He was married to Jeanette Nolan, who was one of the voices that they used for Mother.
Ah!
Oh, so there were actors, different actors playing the voice of Mother.
Yeah,
it wasn't just Norman doing
there
karaoke.
There was Jeanette Nolan and Virginia Gregg, and then this guy, Paul Jasmine, I think is his name, who was a friend of Perkins. I think he was his understudy, or no, his double or something. But yeah, and they in the editing room, they purposely mixed up mid-sentence these different takes to confuse people. But it's all Virginia Gregg in the last scene, in the overdub at the last shot. No, that's Lorene Tuttle, but Virginia Gregg is, you look her up on IMDb, she's been in everything.
And the sheriff's wife mm-hmm. refers to the operator as Flory. Like, this is a small town and everyone's, you know, everybody knows everybody. So they would just pick up the phone and talk to the operator and tell her where to send the call.
Yep.
Right, but where's the marijuana grow operation?
That's what the wife's doing. That's why she's so happy.
Yeah. That's why she was already up. She's in the basement.
Oh, I'm just tending
to
the garden. What's in the garden? Doesn't matter.
And the Asian sex ring.
Again,
going,
tending
like,
to the
that?
Garden. What's in the garden? Never you mind.
Of course, Norman is freaking out right now.
That's for the listeners. That's for the listeners that don't know Bates Motel. Yes, this little town has a marijuana grow up. That's like the backbone business in the community, in addition to an Asian sex ring. They there's a lot of crazy storylines that go on in the TV show, but it's fun. It makes me think of Oz, like the TV show Oz, and just how over the top that show was.
Yeah, the prison drama. Norman
found them dead together. Yeah,
this is my favorite. From HBO. Norman found them dead together.
In bed. Yes!
In bed.
And you just know that she does that with her fortune cookies when she gets Chinese food. You know, she adds in bed to everything.
Oh my god, yeah, I've heard that. Yeah, you add in bed to the back of everything.
You'll have much success
you'll
in
find
the new year.
Much success in bed.
In bed. We may have to put a PG rating
on this episode.
I love this line. Who's that woman buried out in Green Lawn Cemetery? Because it's so good. You can tell, like, that'd be the perfect end. I think it is almost the end of a chapter in the book.
Right, but if you think about it, though, who is buried out there? Or because the mum's not there,
no,
so
no,
did
they
he
do
just
say
go and dig
it's
her
a,
up
it's
later
a weighted
on and
coffin.
Take away the corpse?
It is it,
but they say that at the end.
I
think that was
okay.
Another red herring, because the audience may already be suspecting, you know, the truth. And you can't say that.
They're probably suspecting something's not quite right with Norman, even if they can't put the finger on it.
My dad said that when he saw it back in the day, and he was, you know, in his 30s, that he figured it out when Arbogast was murdered, because he thought no old lady would have that much power. I've never heard anyone else say that.
I don't
know. Of course,
know.
Here's another decoy, which is... moving the camera up to keep you not thinking that that there may not be a Mrs. Bates, actually.
Oh, that surprises me that anybody would figure it out, because I think they did a great job, because the multiple voices, you know, the in the shadows, again, with being in the 60s and whatnot, like, seeing a woman with a woman's clothing and whatnot, like, you wouldn't really be expecting them to put a wig and everything on as well, I guess. But, you know, but yeah, even here with this scene, moving the body.
But lest you...
So, I don't know.
Mrs. Bates is dead, as the sheriff says. That line about who's buried in the cemetery, and then this scene makes you think, ooh, Norma's been fooling everybody all this time, and she actually is alive. So you're still with
her.
So this set here is... in, I don't know what they call that square at Universal, but it's famous for Back to the Future.
Right, the courthouse set. The courthouse square. Yeah. The town square.
And I always wonder about those people, like, who are they?
All the extras in the background?
Yeah, like, they're a couple little kids, and it's like, if I was a little kid who had a walk-on part in Psycho, I'd write a book. You know, who are these people? Where are they?
Yeah. They were probably just children of people on the set or children of the other actors.
That's why they're running off to, like, oh, gotta make deliveries.
Are you like me when you get bored watching a TV show or a film and you start looking at the extras in the background and figuring out who's doing repetitive laps and who's, you know, and trying to figure out their, you know, how they're directing all that action in the background.
I always like to find the ones who are doing a really shit job. Like, there's that famous one of Quantum of Solace, the Bond film, where in the back there's a guy who's supposed to be, like, sweeping up, except his broom isn't actually touching the ground. So he's doing the motion. And if you look in the background, like, Daniel Craig's on a motorbike, in the background, he's not doing anything. He's just sort of making the motions, not touching the ground, but it's like a foot off the ground.
He's air mopping.
Sounds like an average worker to me.
And you know about the child extra in North by Northwest,
yes.
Right?
Oh, that's that. I love
What's
that?
That?
One, where he covers his. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because of the gun, yep. So
here we are. Norman's really scared. Someone's at that window. I just
saw the curtain. He's like, why is it so busy here? I'm just trying to read my book. Like, I wish that woman never would have come here.
Yeah. And it's almost painful to watch this because you know that neither party believes the other and that it's all just so phony, but they're just doing it because they feel they have to.
The modern day of privacy concerns, you would never be able to pick up the register and see who had previously checked into the hotel and all their personal data. That would have been a lawsuit.
Yeah, not anymore.
I love the editing here with the smile that passes but then you between can't... her and Norman. It's just about to happen. It's just so cool. Hello.
I get your bags, haven't I? I love how the real message of this film is that if you're going to kill someone, make sure there's someone without any family connections. Yeah, yes. No one who's going to kill someone who won't be missed, because then you won't have their nosy relatives coming in the way.
So a night in the hotel is $10. I'll go on ahead. They're very suspicious.
He doesn't give them cabin one.
Nope. Well, I wouldn't either. Goodness gracious.
There's a documentary I saw a couple of years ago of a real story of a real hotel in the States where the owner had catwalks in the ceiling of the motel, and he would lurk around in the attic at night and watch couples making love through the vents in the ceiling. And apparently, like, the people that bought the hotel after he retired found this, and there was, like, every single room in the motel, there's a place where he could perch and look down on the bed. And the man who had done this was in the documentary, and he had been discovered and was getting criminal charges against him. It was an amazing story. But it's very creepy to think that would actually happen in real life.
Yeah. I mean, there's also that one of... Is it E.E. Holmes? Who was the guy in the 1920s who built a bed and breakfast hotel thing, but it was designed to... There was booby traps in it. So he basically killed people in the hotel when they would trigger certain mechanisms and stuff.
Like they'd pull a book off of a shelf and the floor would open?
Yeah.
Wow.
Weird.
That would never happen in Canada.
No, in Canada you just find like
you get a toque and a plate of waffles in your room. With some syrup, maple syrup. Now is this?
What's the weather like in Regina right now?
It's
rainy, very very gray.
Which is okay.
Rainy.
I'm not a fan of the hot weather.
Same here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're going back to investigate room number one?
Yes.
And
of course, he walks in and says, Bates, because you want the person that you're... you want to be discovered.
And the door is unlocked, which, yeah, okay, that happens. Anyway. I guess if he's trying to trap and kill people, maybe the door would be left open.
I mean, didn't she test it? Wasn't that the point? Yeah.
Yeah, she did.
Which still
it
makes
earlier.
You wonder why it's open.
True.
Mm-hmm. I think he just never got around to locking it. I bet you if we look back, because he got distracted by that vehicle, right? Like a vehicle went by when he was closing the door. He probably just didn't. He just got distracted.
But
from
it's
locking
been
it.
Almost
have to
a week.
Watch and go back and check.
You would think. I mean, it's been.
Mm-hmm. There's no.
It's 7 days since the murder. So you would think that by then he would have locked it. But then that's something that you're not supposed to think about the first time.
There's no shower curtain. Mm-hmm.
There's no shower curtain. But that old woman, whoever she is, she told our guest something. I want her to tell us
the same thing. You can't go up there. See, I think, too, with those, you know, you can get those criminal detectives nowadays where they can, like, spray that stuff and then run the black light over it to see the blood. Like, the mop that he cleaned up, like, he's definitely...
The mop is in the trunk of the car.
Sure, that mop wouldn't have done that good a job. Mm-hmm. Which could definitely hold more than one body. Those old types of cars, those
they were
you could get a whole family in that trunk.
Five-body trunk. Can you find your way back to
town? Yes, of course. They don't make them like they used to.
If you do get anything, don't stop to tell me. That's such bullshit. Of course you stop and tell them.
Da, da, da.
And then this is a kind of a freak out because you're about to see that Norman is just standing right there and might have heard everything that they were saying, might have even been looking.
Hello.
Do you know, Pat, the reception of this film
when
this came out?
Critically, not very good, but it was a runaway hit.
Okay. The critics didn't really like it.
But a lot of them revised their opinions later, especially, I think, Vincent Canby of the New York Times, I think. Mm-hmm. I think it shocked people. It was so different from anything that they were expecting from any filmmaker, and especially from Alfred Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm. Didn't Hitchcock say he kind of wanted to treat it as a bit of a dark comedy? So that it wasn't as horrific as it could have been?
Yeah, but his sense of humor, I think, is lost on most people. Especially in this, if he thinks it's funny.
I think that's a British humor.
Yeah.
British humor's pretty dry. And Hitchcock's like the master of that dry humor. Like, he is
no,
really dry.
Really?
Yeah, very... Like, I've been watching the Alfred Hitchcock Presents shows, too, and, like, all those jokes are so dry. Like, you know, he's always, generally always poking fun at, like, the commercial people, what's the term, like, the sponsors of the shows and stuff. He's generally always poking fun at them and you know, burning, gives them some burns. So, very dry.
It's very evident in Trouble with Harry. But also in Stage Fright. When you get to Stage Fright, you'll see a lot of that British...
And in Frenzy, there's a lot of very dark kind of body horror comedy going on.
Again, the cinematography, there's shadows and light and mirrors. Everything in the frame is there for a reason, for a purpose.
Yeah, well, it's like what Pat said about the chiaroscuro about it. It's just everything's balanced in a really macabre way.
And just look at the art direction in these scenes, you know, for scenes that were going to be, you know, less than a minute. But there's so much detail.
Well, it adds a lot.
That the mother's bedroom is, to me, the most horrific physical space in the entire film. That's the room of horror right there to me. Like the bathroom and the suite one in the hotel doesn't bother me as much as this bedroom bothers me.
Yeah, it's really just ghostly frightening. And that statue of the two hands that we're about to see. Just where did they get that?
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what bothers me is these old sinks where the hot and the cold water aren't together. We had one of those in the first house I lived in as a kid. And I hated those kinds of sinks.
And the indentation of the body in the bed. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
not saying you shouldn't be content. Wow. Here. I'm just doubting that you are. But yeah, that the impression of that, the terror of that bedroom is amazing.
I grew up in that house up there. I had a very happy childhood.
I had a very happy childhood. My mother and I were more than happy. Yeah, well, you were not. My mother told me I was happy.
And then this. Norman's room. Still sleeping there. And I hope this doesn't sound like a spoiler, but that bunny... that bunny shows up in Bates Motel.
Oh, really?
Is it?
Yeah.
So I'll take a look.
Keep an eye out for it.
I gotta say, I'm glad that my microphone messing up is not affecting me playing this copy of the video here, because I'm now on my fourth audio file for this. I don't know what is up with my computer today.
Oh, boy. So. Are you the one who edits?
I am, so fortunately, oh. it's my cross to bear, I guess, so I need a new computer. Patreon.com/
We can have a GoFundMe for all the listeners,
so
of our show.
In the novel, it's established that there is pornography in the book that she's looking at.
Okay. About your motel. When was the book written, do you know?
59, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it came out in 59.
So like right, oh, they just did this movie like right away then.
Well, that's why I thought, because the 59, the number appears a lot in the first half of the film, and I thought, oh, is that... Is it just a coincidence, or is it just like a little nod to the...
And didn't Hitchcock have people go out and buy the book off the shelves so that nobody would know the story? And during film production, they had everybody swear an oath that nobody would talk about the story, nobody would reveal the ending. It was all very top secret and very hush-hush.
Yeah.
And the one person who broke it was Lorene Tuttle, who played the sheriff's wife. She... I forget what it was, but she said something that she shouldn't have in an interview.
Uh-oh.
Here we go. Now, when I was a kid, it was this scene, not the shower scene, that just drew me to the movie, because it scared the crap out of me, and of course people are most fascinated by the things that scare them.
So we know there's a lot of levels in the home. There's the basement, there's the main floor, the kitchen... There's the top floor with the bedrooms, and this is the depth of the basement, the depth of horror here.
This house is just massive. I love it. I wish I had a house like this.
And the audience is going, no, don't go there.
And there's another basement, another cellar. This is like a fourth level down.
It's the mother. There was a mother
Mrs.
the
Bates,
whole
it's...
time.
Hello.
I fucking love this.
Oh my
that,
god!
It's the sunken eye sockets. It's the grin. It's oh. And then here she is.
That is so messed up.
And I've actually kind of that weird half scream. No, my mates. Ah.
So I wonder if at this point people are, like, confused or if everything just clicks for them. Like, I've seen this movie so many times that I know what's going on, right? But
yeah, it's hard to know.
I wonder if at the first they're just like, what is happening? So.
Wow.
Oh, I love it.
But the movie could end there. So everything we're about to see is almost extra. It's almost unnecessary. And people have said that the explanation of what's happened, like the explanation of the psychology, was not needed, but
it's not
or
needed
was it
now.
Needed? Yeah, like in the day, it was needed to try and explain to people what was going on.
I've never had a problem with it.
I really like this. It's like a denouement. It closes it out. But I also love the psychiatrist, because he's only in this scene, but it's just such a fantastic character performance.
Yeah.
Did he kill my sister? Yes, and no.
And no.
What?
And it does still bother me that you don't see her
merely
cry
tries
or
to
anything.
Explain. I know, I've seen this film too many times. I keep mouthing along to the words.
Yeah.
I haven't seen this movie too many times. I think I've only seen this movie maybe 4 or 5 times. I don't know.
Novice.
I'm going to say I've seen this at least 20.
Do you even like Hitchcock, Brandon?
It's like, what's your damage, Miss Atla? What's your damage?
They have 2 unconfirmed murder cases of young women.
Yeah.
In the 1983 film, they talk about 7 murders have happened.
Mm.
Oh.
Canon inconsistency.
No, but because more time has elapsed. It's 20 years later, right?
Well, isn't in Psycho 2, he's just getting out of prison, isn't he?
Yeah, he's been in a psychiatric prison for 22 years at the point.
Yeah, he's just getting out at that time, so anything in between wouldn't have been him.
Or was it? Maybe it was Mother doing the murders.
Could have been.
The calendar in the background we just saw, you know, is wrong if you take everything literally. Because if the movie really did begin on Friday, December 11th, and you do the counting and all that, it doesn't add up.
Well, I saw the 17. So
yeah, that would have been like a Thursday or something. That's the kind of thing I used to think about.
Oh my God, Pat, just enjoy the movie.
In the fruit cellar, did they drag the swamp? There's a lot of references there.
She was a corpse.
So he began to think and speak for her. Gave her half his life,
I
so
like
to speak.
It, not...
My God, I love this. I love this so much.
It's great. It, you know, never mind the exposition for the answer that we all can figure out now, but it's just great to have these things colored
in.
Mm-hmm.
And it is useful, you know, like you said, for 1960... Psychology wasn't a massively known field, so people would have been going, what the hell was all that? You know, so
right. It
is useful.
But today, they could have cut right to the final scene and skipped this entirely, and people would have got it.
Mm-hmm.
They would have, but you know what it would have been? There'd have been at least 20 of those really annoying videos on YouTube where it's like, Psycho ending explained.
Explained.
Like, they do it for films that don't need explaining. I saw one that was like, Men in Black International explained, and I'm like, it doesn't need explaining. It's not an intense film. I can tell you what's going to happen from the trailer. It doesn't need explaining. You know, a film like
Toy Story 4 explained.
Yeah, like a film like Us that came out earlier this year, and I love Us, and it's great.
Don't you dare spoil it
for me. I'm just saying, but that is one where it's like ending explained kind of makes sense because there's a lot going on. But you don't need it for every kind of film. You know, this I can understand why they might do it, but then I'm really glad this happened in 1960, where they can just put this in, and it goes, right, okay. So for those of you who don't know about X, Y, and Z, here you go. Here's a nice performance. It wraps up all of the characters. It lets you know that Sam and Lila are safe. You know? And then you get the coolest little stinging monologue.
So what you're saying is Hitchcock did the first YouTube explained video.
Pretty much. I mean, to be fair, didn't he do it on, like, Alfred Hitchcock Presents? Like, when he used to just kind of, at the end, he used to give, like, a little monologue going, like, oh, well, da-da-da-da-da-da. And then he just...
Well, his stuff for the show was always like, okay, so the story would be over, and then it would cut to him and be like, well, just so you know, that person did get their comeuppance.
Yeah.
And they went to prison for this, and they got caught because they...
Now,
they went to the next town and did this or whatever it is.
And again, that was for the censors.
Yeah, because of censors and whatnot. So.
Here's the cameo.
Let someone get away with it.
The cameo I was talking about. That's Ted Knight right there.
Oh, we missed it.
Nope.
No, right there. That's him. In the cop.
Who's Ted?
Hi, guys.
Ted Knight from the Mary Tyler Moore Show. He was in Caddyshack, the movie.
Oh,
he played the bumbling anchor on the Mary Tyler Moore Show. Anyway.
Ah.
Oh,
those are 3 references
I
do not get.
I love our Darth Vader death moment here.
Yes. Consumed
this is
by the dark side.
The acting in this scene is amazing.
And in the end, he intended to tell them that I killed those girls and that man.
Like one of his stuffed birds.
Yeah.
I could see Freddie Highmore sitting here doing this.
Oh, yeah. And I won't. I'll just sit here and be quiet, just in case they do suspect me.
Suspect me.
They're watching me.
Yeah.
I wonder how long it took them to get the fly to do this thing.
It's probably a train flight. Probably had its own like trailer.
And here we go with the superimposition of the.
So creepy.
I love it.
Face. Yeah. Oh, that's great.
So Brandon,
do you guys like the final shot of the car getting pulled out?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure. Yeah.
The end.
Who do we have to thank, Brandon?
Okay, excellent. Thank you guys so much. We want to thank the Fandom Podcast Network for hosting our show. We'd like to thank our good friend Jason Cullimore for creating our wonderful theme song. You can find us on Twitter at Good Evening Pod. You can send us an email, goodeveningpodcast@gmail.com. Pat, thank you so much for joining us. Can you give us a quick, are you on Twitter, anywhere people can find you other than that Hitchcock group?
No, I've never gotten along with Twitter.
Okay.
But you can find me on Alfred Hitchcock Geek, and thank you so much for inviting me. This has been fun.
Awesome, we had a great time. You can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella, and you guys know what other podcasts you can find me on. Chris, where can they find you on Twitter?
You can find me on Hi_Boy, and yeah, you can find me on Good Evening Pod, and I'll be guesting on a bunch of different podcasts, but feel free, come and say hi. Tell me what your fan casts are for the upcoming 50th reboot of Psycho. Yes.
Tom, where can people find you on Twitter?
I'm going to be Tom Caldwell 3000 on Twitter, but I'm going to go buy a car for $700 and try to check into Bates Motel. It looks like an interesting place.
Excellent. Okay, guys. Well, until next time, when we are actually going to cover Jamaican Inn, which will be on our next episode. Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening. Good evening.